It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This September, thousands are expected to descend on Salisbury for the National Folk Festival. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. National phenomenon will take place from September 7th through the 9th of this year and is expected to draw as many as 150,000 people. The festival will be featuring musical acts that will represent the best of the national tradition. Our guests in the studio this morning are Julie Olin. She is the executive director of the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Also, Blaine Wade. He's the council's programming manager. And Caroline O'Hare, who is the local manager for the festival. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Julie, I want to start with you and talk a little bit about, we've announced the first, I think it's about eight acts or so. Tell me a little bit about the music, the kind of music that you've announced so far.
Well, I think people will be surprised at the scope and diversity of the musicians that are going to be performing at the festival. This is the National Folk Festival really intends to be a national showcase with artists from every part of the nation to just show how amazing the cultural traditions of our nation are.
And Blaine, I want to turn to you. Group to me or tell me a little bit about, before we go into the individual acts, is there something, a theme that connects these? What decided these are at least the first ones you want to get?
Oh, well, the overall sort of, to use the word you use, theme that we're looking at with all the artists we select is they represent the best of or the most excellent practitioners of their respective traditions in the country. This really is, as Julia said, a national showcase. And these are artists who, within their own communities where these traditions are very much part of the community life there and the cultural identity there, these are the artists who excel and are the most authentic by those standards in those communities. So that's going to be the theme running throughout the artists we select for each year of the National. As for the first eight artists, it's really about trying to capture a range of the diversity of cultures represented, forms of music, including music and dance, and giving the community here a sense of in a little snapshot in these first eight artists of what they can be excited about, what's going to be coming here in September.
So, as a matter of fact, it seems to be, before we get into the individuals, a range in terms of just cultural reflections, everything from Korea to Hispanic community and so on. Tell me a little bit about that connection. Because you seem to sort of span a number of different aspects of American society and culture. Or Caroline?
Oh, yeah. Well, something that the NCTA spoke to our programming, our musical programming advisory committee about is saying, let's look at your community. Let's look at who's involved in your entire community, the populations, the cultures, the diversity of it. And let's start programming this festival not only to represent the nation, but to also include all the cultures in our community, in Delmarva, in Maryland. For example, you had mentioned Korea, and we have a large Korean population. So that needs to be acknowledged. They are part of our community. So those are the types of ideas when they were looking at genres of what works best for Delmarva, but also represents, just like Blaine and Julia have mentioned, excellence and authenticity. So there's a lot of thought that goes into this, and it's an exciting array of performers that are coming, and we want to speak to all Americans and the community members right here in Salisbury and on Delmarva.
Julie?
Well, the festival is very intentionally reflects our contemporary cultural landscape in the United States. And to do that, we have to look at the traditions, say, of Native peoples who have been here for millennia, and traditions, vernacular traditions that have developed over hundreds of years here that are distinctively American, as well as those of the most recent arrivals and immigrant refugee populations that now make their home in the United States. So I think that it would be safe to say there is no other event in the United States that really attempts in one weekend to cover all this territory.
By the way, there's sort of this emphasis on the one hand of local as opposed to, say, national. Is there a balance as you look at the various acts and on arts that you represent? I mean, is there a balance between what's expressed locally and then also what's national?
Yes, very intentionally. As we've said, of course, it's a national showcase. However, within this mix, we are going to be featuring the best of the state and the best of the region. There is a particular area of the festival, the Maryland Traditions Folklife area, that is going to be devoted exclusively to the traditions of Maryland and the Delmarva Peninsula. The marketplace as well is going to be all Maryland and Delmarva, as well as performers mixed into the entire mix of the festival.
So I want to turn to actually one of the first ones, which is Michael Cleveland and the Flame Keeper, a blind fiddler. Lane, tell me a little bit about Michael.
Sure. Michael grew up in a community in southern Indiana, just across from the Ohio River, from Louisville, Kentucky. Took an interest in music at a very, very young age. But as you noted, he's blind, so it took some sort of special teaching, guidance to help him get going. He attended the Kentucky School for the Blind. But once he got his bearings, he just took off and was performing with backing major musicians at a young age, playing with an all-star group at the Grand Ole Opry. And then shortly after high school, he's backing Dale Ann Bradley and Rhonda Vincent. But for a number of years now, well over a decade, he's been fronting his own band, Flame Keeper. He's one of the most exceptional fiddlers in bluegrass music. He's the 10-time winner of Fiddler of the Year from the International Bluegrass Music Association. And his band is just instrumentally on fire, to sort of reference their name. They are 5-time winners of the Instrumental Band of the Year from the International Bluegrass Music Association.
So let's hear just a little bit of his music. And truly, this particularly bluegrass, it is probably one of the most traditional, at least recognizable American traditions in terms of music. I mean, and I'm sure it's been part of the festival for many years.
It has. And, most people don't realize bluegrass is, in the scheme of things, a relatively modern music. It developed in the 1940s from a blend of old-time string band music with elements of jazz and blues and other American forms. And it was really made possible, actually, by the microphone, because that equalized the ability of softer instruments to compete, so that you could have all these hot solos of guitars and mandolins and fiddles. And so the changes in technology allowed for the development of bluegrass.
I want to turn to something quite different, which is, I guess, the sounds of Korea. Blaine, tell me a little bit about them.
Sure. This is probably the premier traditional arts performing ensemble of Korean music and dance in the United States. They're based in New York City, and the group was founded by Soo Park. Soo Park hails originally from South Korea and took an interest in traditional dance at a young age. I learned from just absolute masters there, and since coming to the States has been a leading advocate and performer for her community and her tradition. She's been recognized by the National Endowment of the Arts with a National Heritage Fellowship, which is the nation's highest honor for the folk and traditional arts. And also what really speaks to how significant she is she's also been recognized with several honors back in South Korea from the Ministry of Culture there. And so this is going to be a great group that comes and performs different traditional dances, the fan dance, a traditional drumming dance, and should really, really strike a significant impact and tone here in the Salisbury community.
Truly, how important is dance to this whole component of music, do you think?
Well, you know, in traditional culture, music and dance often go hand in hand. So it's quite important. And there will not only be groups that are performing on stage, but there's an entire huge tent at the festival that's devoted to participatory dance. So there'll be all types of music there for audience members to get involved and dance to.
And also, before we leave Western music, there's a Western singing group called the Quebe Sisters. Cool. Blaine, tell me a little bit about them.
Sure. That's the Quebe Sisters.
Quebe Sisters, okay.
They are three sisters from Burleson, Texas, which is in the greater Dallas area. And they were taking violin lessons as young girls, and then went to a Texas fiddling competition and were just blown away by what they saw. So really, within a year, they were winning contests and have went on to excel. And it was shortly after they released their first album that Ricky Skaggs, the great bluegrass and country performer, encouraged them to start singing on their own. And so now they sing harmony, they fiddle in harmony, and it's very much as if Bob Wills met the Andrews Sisters. So it's absolute, really charming from stage, top-notch performers.
And let's hear a little of them. And Julie, they remind me of the Andrews Sisters. That's the first thing that popped to my mind, the kind of music you would have maybe heard in the 1940s.
I know. You know, as they say, the heyday of Western swing may have passed for some, but in Texas, Bob Wills is still the king.
And in terms of, like, is that the tradition? Is it something that... that is really important in terms of remembering that kind of music, that maybe perhaps become more aware of that kind of music that maybe in other parts of the country might not be as aware of, do you think?
Well, it's true.
Is it possible to get lost, maybe?
What's so cool about the festival is we're bringing a lot of regional traditions where they may have had a moment, say, of national fame at some point, but they never lost popularity at home. So there have always been these great artists that have been keeping these traditions. These gals are very young. I mean, they're in their 20s. And it's not considered ossified, you know, artifact of music. I mean, this is a living tradition in Texas, and it's very exciting to have a chance to, you know, be exposed to that.
Mm. Also, I wanted to move on to Clinton Fearon and the Boogie Brown Band. Blaine, tell me a little bit about them.
Sure. So Clinton Fearon, with all of the groups we present at the festival, it's about artists that really represent that deep tradition. And Clinton very much does that in terms of a roots reggae artist. He was a performer for many years with the Gladiators, one of the seminal groups, reggae performing groups in Jamaica. And then ended up settling in the U.S. and founding his own band, the Boogie Brown Band, that will be coming to the festival here. And he's really carrying the torch forward for that deeply rooted, deeply spiritual essence that's at the core of reggae music.
And Julie, reggae has its own particular niche that's really very established, and most people can at least recognize it.
That's true. It remains highly popular with all ages, and Clinton is so important because he represents the essence of that tradition, which is very much tied. It's religious, it's spiritual, it's a message of hope and a struggle for justice and equality. And it was very much tied with the with Rastafarianism in the 1960s when reggae emerged. And it was this fusion that made it such a powerful music. And we like to present those kinds of artists that bring that original concept and power to the stage when they perform.
Let's hear a little of that.
One, two, three, and four. Dup, 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 One love and the children singing. One love they are singing in the background. One love and the children shouting. One love they are shouting in the background. Where is equal rights and justice? It's nowhere to be found. It's nowhere to be found. If you got it in your bosom, your bosom. Check it out, check it out, so that we all can be redeemed.
And of course, a lot of the music, particularly for a lot of us, when it became apparent with Bob Marley and this that whole tradition there.
Yeah, and I know he's not saying this, but I like to think he's saying the children were singing in the bathtub.
And also, the next one, and I'm going to let you pronounce this right here.
Imyamyar Hasanov and Abos Kosimov.
So, Blaine, so tell me then a little about their music.
Sure. Imyamyar is Azerbaijani, a master Azerbaijani musician. He lives in San Francisco now. After migrating to the U.S., he lived in Virginia for a bit, and he's been in San Francisco where he's the director of a world music festival there. He is a master performer on the Comanche, which is a spiked one-string fiddle that you sort of perch on your knee and play. And Azerbaijan is a culture and a nation there at the crossroads of Eastern Europe, Central Asia, and cultural currents coming through along the Silk Road and lots of influences along that trade and that trade route. And He grew up, he performed from a very young age with the National Orchestra, and since coming to the States has collaborated with just a who's who of musicians. And Abos, who will be performing with him, is somebody he's been playing with for a number of years, who plays a number of different frame drums that, depending on the culture, bear different names. And they're just a wonderful performance together, drawing on these sonic traditions coming out of the Central Asia region.
So, Julie, so is this a combination of, and we'll hear in just a moment, but a combination of some, say, Middle East, because obviously there's a Muslim population, and then there's sort of this Russian kind of portion of the continent. What, is there a mix here? What how do you see this music, do you think?
Well, it's really, there's a culture zone that you could say it's Turco-Persian.
Okay.
These are very, very ancient traditions, but you will find similarities. And Abos is actually from Uzbekistan.
Hmm.
And then Imyamyar, the player of the Comanche, is from Azerbaijan. But that whole area was very much influenced by Persian culture. So you'll hear all of those, but it's a meeting place, a crossroads for centuries of trade in that region. So they were influenced right and left, right, up and down from all these different cultural traditions, you know, sort of merging in the area.
Let's hear a little bit of that. By the way, do they still live in their respective countries? Have they immigrated?
No, everybody at the festival pretty much now makes their home in the United States.
Okay.
Abos, the percussionist, lives in Sacramento, and Imamyar is in San Francisco.
So they're all around the country, as it were. Also, we have the Marietta Los Camperos. Tell me, Blaine, a little bit about them. Actually, I guess sort of reminds me of where I come. I grew up actually in Los Angeles, which of course had a great, you know, Hispanic music tradition, particularly East LA and so on. Tell me a little bit about them.
Sure, and they've been performing in LA now for, I believe, nearly 60 years. They are, many would call, the finest mariachi ensemble in the world. They were founded by a gentleman named Nati Cano, who grew up learning the tradition in his home state of Jalisco, and was very committed when he came to the States to drawing attention to mariachi and trying to bring it out of people's consciousness as cantina music and see it more as a high art form. And so he created and opened La Fonda, which was the first ever dinner theater restaurant in L.A. to go see mariachi music. And the Comperos played there for years and years until it closed, but they've reopened it again since 2016 and are back playing at La Fonda. Nati Cano was a hugely influential figure in the form, teaching, passing the tradition on to generation upon generation of performers, and he was recognized with the National Heritage Fellowship as well by the National Endowment for the Arts.
Let's see here a little bit of that.
Hi.
Yeah, Julie, as a matter of fact, somebody made the observation that that particular music, which obviously comes out of Mexico and the whole border area, that's in comparison to the other music in Latin America, it's kind of the country western kind of flavor to it. There's this kind of sort of gaucho style to it, as opposed to maybe some of the other forms within Latin America.
Yeah, and you know, it came from the west central state, Mexican state of Jalisco originally, mm-hmm. and there were. Mexico is a large country, all these different regional styles, but this mariachi came to the attention of the burgeoning a movie industry in the 1930s, and that sort of propelled it to much, well, actually worldwide attention. Today, it's sort of recognized as a national symbol of the state of Mexico, and the Los Camperos were featured on Linda Ronstadt's sort of breakthrough recordings. If people remember Canciones de mi Padre, that was a Grammy Award-winning project years ago, and have gone on to also win Grammys of their own since then.
How important is that? I mean, we have a large and we have a growing, actually, Hispanic population within the United States, probably the fastest growing, I think, portion of it. Does that then propel it to be even more important, more pervasive as we demographically change, you think?
Yes, I do. And this particular group and others are great teachers. They're traveling around the country. You know, there are now high schools in Texas where there are mariachi music programs. So, yeah, I think it's becoming ever more a sound in our national, an important sound in our national soundscape.
Also went to, is it Marquise Knox, I guess it is. Blaine, tell me then a little about that act.
Oh, sure. Marquise is a wonderful performer. He's a young artist carrying the forward of the tradition of the blues into the 21st century. We like to say he's an old soul for a 27-year-old, and he just turned 27. Marquise has been out playing since he was a mid-teenager, in his mid-teenage years. He's from St. Louis. He's been living in St. Louis, but his family roots are down in Grenada, Mississippi, which falls at the sort of the intersection of the Delta and the Mississippi Hill Country. And those are two distinct traditions in the blues coming together. And Marquise has those deep roots in Mississippi, but has been influenced by a number of figures, including Henry Townsend, really a foundational figure in the history of St. Louis blues, and himself a National Heritage Fellow. Marquise also had the tradition passed on to him by his grandmother, his uncle, Big George Brock, a harmonica player and singer, is also a relative. So it's no exaggeration to say for Marquise that he's got the blues in his blood. And he's just an amazing performer with great energy and great respect for the tradition.
Well, let's hear a little blues here.
Well, there are two trains running. Well, and now one hole going my way. Well, now one running at midnight, and the other one a running just for day. A running just for day. A running just for day.
It really is a real soulfulness of the Mississippi, really that very traditional, kind of, almost soulful kind of cry, as it were, from life.
Well, I'm from St. Louis, so, you know, I have a bias here. But when I first heard him, I lost it. I was like, I never thought that I would ever hear a young bluesman evoke the power that that recalls Muddy Waters or Son House or just that generation that really took the blues, not Son House didn't, but that really took the blues up river to Chicago, you know. It's just, so he's stunned me, and I'm a total fan.
If I wanted to wrap up with Orquesta SCC, Blaine, what's that act all about?
Sure. This is a group in New York City, a real who's who on the Latin music scene there in New York City, who are committed to bringing back the sounds of salsa dura, or hardcore salsa. These are guys who grew up with a real appreciation for the origins of the music in New York City's Spanish-speaking barrios. And over time, the music had lost that edge of social commentary and speaking to Latino community identity that was there when it emerged in the 1970s. And this is a group of guys really committed to bringing it back to that sound, back to the street, back to that energy. And that's what they do in the music. They are going to rock the dance tent, and they're going to play hard and play late. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Let's hear a little of them.
Cuando la salsa llega al pie y pide campana, los coristas sus voces hacen sonar. Falta una cosa, un elemento, para poner al público siempre a gozar. Y le dicen, son, 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 sonero, dale bien duro a los cueros, son, son, son.
And truly, that still stands completely in contrast to the mariachi music.
Totally.
You know, completely. Tell me a little bit about how significant is this? And there are other flavors, too, of Hispanic music, Spanish music, that really kind of like run the gamut, I think, in the United States.
Oh, yeah. There are, from as many places as people have come, those right. musics are here. There's, you know, South American music, Colombian music. There's a... music from the Caribbean. I mean, salsa was really born in New York. I mean, yes, it's Puerto Rican, it's Afro-Cuban mixed with jazz, but it really, the barrios of New York where this was born. And interestingly enough, like a lot of the artists that will come to the festival who are so extraordinary, they, you know, they didn't maybe even start out doing music full time. The two leaders of this band were both working in the same building in New York. One was working for ESPN, and the other was working for ABC as an accountant. And they were, you know, they'd always played music, but a messenger in the building introduced them to each other, and that's how this band got started about 10 years ago. And then, of course, they've been playing music full time since then.
And this is only the beginning of this is only this first.
Oh,
how many
yeah.
acts? How many acts? Music acts? Do you think you'll have?
Well, probably 35 performing groups. But if you add together all of the artists at the festival and the craftspeople and the artisans, well, there'll be 350 altogether, probably, or more.
Hey, Caroline, so is this going to be a culture shock for Delmarva, or are all these communities here, we just don't necessarily notice them?
It's going to be an amazing opportunity for cultures to be shared because these cultures exist all across America. This is an American celebration. It's celebrating all Americans. And our community is diverse and it's rich. And I'm so excited that not only do we get to introduce new music and new cultures to someone that may not be familiar with it, but we're also acknowledging our neighbors, our friends, our coworkers, their cultures, their backgrounds, their experiences by bringing their style and flavor to the forefront at this festival. When we were listening to the Salsadora, I remember seeing that band actually perform in Greensboro. And when I initially was told, let's go see this band, I was like, oh, well, you know, I guess I'm not really familiar with salsa. I was jumping around like a crazy person. It was so energetic, so joyful to see thousands and thousands of people, just huge smiles from young kids all the way to our older citizens, and just so much energy and joy. You just lost yourself in this band. And I noticed that with every stage I went to, and even just today, listening to these clips of music, when you would play them, I'd look around. We had the engineer Chris in the booth. He's bouncing around. Julia was answering. Everyone has a smile on their face because this music is joyful. It has an energy to it. It has an excitement to it. And to bring that to our community is an incredibly rare and wonderful thing. I'm so happy that that the festival is making its home here for the next 3 years.
Julie, any last words?
Well, you know, people will recognize certain traditions that maybe already are their favorites, and they will come to see their favorites, and that's great. But you know what? They're going to walk away with four or five new favorites of things that they had never heard before. So it's an opportunity to experience what you love, and discover lots of new and exciting music, dance, craft traditions, everything.
Well, we've been speaking with Julie Ola. She's the executive director of the National Council for the Traditional Arts, also Blaine Wade. He's the council's programming manager. And the local manager here is Caroline O'Hare. And no doubt this is just the first of a number, I guess, of
announcements. We're
not done yet.
No, we're not. Our artists are going to be rolled out just about every month until through mid-June, when the schedule will be complete.
Well, I appreciate you all taking the time to stop and chat with us. Blaine, one last word there.
Sure. I just wanted to say, if you go to nationalfolkfestival.com, we've got full bios up of all 8 artists, audio tracks and video samples, as well as links to their websites, their social media pages, so folks can go watch more video, listen to what we heard, learn more about the groups, and start to get to know them.
Sounds are good. Well, I appreciate you all stopping by. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
We're always on the lookout for exciting new music and for righteous gems from the past that just feel right again. We're not looking for a particular genre of music, just top quality and artists that communicate a broad-minded, inclusive set of values. Hey, I'm Greg McVicker, and I hope you'll make Undercurrents a regular part of your evening routine. Weeknights at 9 p.m. on WSDL, 90.7 Rhythm and News.
U.S. Justice Department's Office to Obtain Legal Representation for Low-Income People is reported to be quietly shutting down, and what is known as pro bono work may be more important than ever. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Here in Salisbury, a new office is being opened up by Midshore Pro Bono, which provides legal services for those who cannot afford the high-priced lawyer. Back in 2015, they partnered with senior centers to offer legal help to low-income seniors, and that led them to open up an office here in Wicomico County. In our studio this morning is Sandy Brown. She's the executive director of Midshore Pro Bono, and also Juanita Sutton, who is the intake paralegal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, well, Sandy, tell me a little bit about the history. I mean, what got you involved in deciding to go pro bono?
Oh, well, gosh, that's a tough question. I've been doing this job for 10 years. Mid-Shore Pro Bono was founded in 2005 as a local, regional nonprofit to serve low-income folks with free legal services. And actually, it was created out of a Maryland rule for lawyers to have local pro bono committees to increase access to justice to people who can't afford attorneys for civil legal matters. Because, of course, in a criminal matter, you have a public defender. But if you have a divorce, custody, or foreclosure, and you can't afford an attorney, there were no resources. So it's kind of like a push towards civil Gideon. So civil right to counsel. So Mid-Shore Pro Bono was created by some judges and lawyers to meet the need on the Eastern Shore. And it was initially, we were based in the five counties. Those were the five counties that we were serving: Kent, Caroline, Talbot, Queen Anne's, and Dorchester. And over the years, over the 10 years that I've been the director, we've just started realizing it that we needed to bring some services to the lower shore counties. And we were able to do that through a grant, through a very generous grant, through a foundation, the Leonard and Helen Stolman Foundation, which saw the need for senior citizens down here on the lower shore and wanted to help us expand our services. So through that, we are opening up our office next month.
There you go.
It's crazy.
What personally attracts you to pro bono work? I mean, how does you think that differs from, say, the regular attorney you might find in downtown Salisbury?
Well, so here's an interesting thing. I'm not an attorney.
Okay.
I play one on TV and on the radio.
Right.
So essentially, I found this job. I was in the higher education industry and working in financial aid. So mm-hmm. I was helping people who couldn't afford to go to college, worked at Washington College, and worked for student loan companies and guarantee agencies, and found myself unemployed in 2008. And Mid-Shore Pro Bono was looking for an executive director. So I said, well, it's kind of the same, you know, financial aid, legal services. So I've been doing it ever since. And I'm not originally from the Eastern Shore. I'm from New York, but I've been living here since 93. And I also feel that the Eastern Shore is kind of left out, right? Not a lot of resources. We don't have public transportation. We have barriers to so many things and so many regular resources that you have in urban areas. And as I started to embrace this job and realized what it really was about, it kind of became a mission of my own to advocate for low-income people to have the same access that somebody else would have. The other sad thing is the law is so complicated. That's why lawyers go to law schools, why doctors go to medical school. And the idea that lawyers should give back and do pro bono work is a hard sell. And we need to advocate for the people who truly need to fix their lives and fix their problems through the help of legal assistance and cannot afford it. And that is a huge challenge, especially on the Eastern Shore, because we don't have a ton of attorneys here. And we don't have a ton of attorneys who can do or will do pro bono work. So it's my mission.
Well, as a matter of fact, now, do you personally get satisfaction of doing this work for people who find themselves in the kind of straits that some people often do, where they may be poor, they may be facing eviction, or they may be facing some civil action?
Yep.
I mean, does that?
Well, helping people has always been a great thing. I feel like I've just helped people all along. I was camp counselor when I was a kid. I think I just have that helping quality. I think that's what Juanita also brings to the table here, is I think it's personally satisfying, it's personally frustrating, and sometimes I feel like if I don't do something, who's going to do it, right? And so you have to find ways to attract attorneys to do this work. You also have to find ways to empower clients to better their lives and pursue something that might be challenging or complex or scary or terrifying. And I have great staff, and we work with people who are at the end of their ropes, who are desperate, who are panicked, who don't know what to do, and they still don't know about us. And so part of the reason why we're down here is we know there is a large low-income population in the lower shore, and we want them to know that there's help.
So. Well, Anita, what drew you to take the job, as it were, I mean, to this kind of organization?
Well, I did an internship with Mitchell Pro Bono over the summer. And really, from the interview, I was drawn to the project because I realized that there was a need. It was something I could really be excited about doing, helping people to get help with things that they probably wouldn't be able to get help otherwise. For instance, seniors who are, you know, it's complicated for them to sit down and try to figure out how to do their will or how to do their advanced medical directive or just to have financial power of attorney or whatever it is they'd like to accomplish. And this program was one where we have clinics that go out to the elder community centers, put on a clinic where the attorney explains what their options are, actually have them sit down and discuss what they would like to, you know, achieve. And then when they come back, they can have their documents furnished and signed and ready to go. They're legal and actionable the day they leave the second appointment. So I thought that was pretty, you know, exciting that they could have that result. And I saw a sense of, you know, that the people really appreciated what was done for them. They, you know, probably would have never, you know, gone and gotten this done on their own. But once they got their paperwork done, they were satisfied. I saw a sense of relief with many of them. And I saw a sense of, yes, I got that taken care of. And they may never have been able to do that. And these are people who, when you say a will to them, they think you're talking about someone with a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But these are things that they could take care of. Maybe it's just their house, who they want their house to go to. So all these things, they're legal matters, but they need help with them. So we're there to do that.
Mm-hmm. But by the way, do you have any sense, Sandy, as to how many people, how many low-income people who take advantage are in need of legal help, and then who are able to take advantage of something like
Wicomico, if you want to just talk about Wicomico County.
Sure.
So there are about 117,000 people in just Wicomico County. In the five counties, just to give you a comparison, so the five original counties that we work with, there's 177,000. So we're going to double the amount of people that we could potentially reach. And about 18% of Wicomico County residents live in poverty. I don't know if you know that. We just understood from the requests that we were getting that it was important for us to have some type of a presence. There are other legal services providers. There are organizations like Maryland Volunteer Lawyer Service that's based in Baltimore. And there's the Legal Aid Bureau and self-help centers. But I think our model works really well. We really want to be a community-based provider. That's why we have Juanita here. People will be able to walk into our office after March 1st.
Right.
You know, 3 days a week. We're starting off slow just to see what it is that we need and build our resources. We're a nonprofit. We don't have a ton of money. You know, we have no fee for service. We charge absolutely nothing for all of our services. There is a $25 application fee. We waive that 90% of the time. So we feel that we join the Chamber of Commerce. As you know, Kathy's been fantastic because she said, oh my gosh, there's a need here. We went to the Community Foundation of the Eastern Shore. They said, sure, we'll give you a small grant because there is a need here. So there's so many different issues. And what we do is really take a wraparound holistic view of a client who comes in. They may come in and think they need a will, power of attorney, advanced medical directive if they're a senior, but they might have a house in foreclosure or they may have some consumer debt, credit card debt that they can't deal with. And our staff will make sure that they get all those things taken care of. And of course, we're going to need to start to recruit some attorneys who are willing to do this for free. Oops, we forgot to mention that. Sorry.
So how do you make the outreach? How do you make people aware, particularly low-income people, aware that this service is available in the first place? I mean, and one of the things I've run across in terms of like it's services for people, poor people, is it's complicated, particularly if you talk about homeless people. Sure. It's like there's a whole vast array of agencies and they have no idea what's available and where to go and when to go. How do you outreach to make sure that people know that this service is available?
Well, so for 10 years, I have been doing nothing but outreach. And it takes a certain kind of personality. My husband calls me a shameless self-promoter. I'm fine with that. And Juanita will be one, too. We will teach her how to be one. But I think It's just a matter of getting out there, coming on the radio, talking to you. You might tell somebody, Kathy's like, oh my God, I totally get what you do. She's going to tell somebody. We join the Chamber of Commerce. We'll go to events. We go to senior centers.
Yes, the senior centers. That was part of my internship. I visited the senior centers and talked with the directors and managers there and really asked for their feedback as to what their clients might need in the way of legal services. And there was a positive response. Most of them were agreeable to us putting on legal clinics at their facilities. That makes it easy for the clients to get there, and they can take in the information they need. They can take the paperwork home. They can have a family member help them with it. And then when they come back, they can be ready to execute their documents. Mm-hmm. So I think it works very, very well by having us go into the community and go to the place where the people are rather than hoping that they somehow find out and show up.
Yeah, so because Mitchell Pro Bono is not an easy name. It doesn't roll off the tongue. It also doesn't explain a lot to what we do. We're trying to rebrand ourselves a little bit. We really consider ourselves a legal resource network because we network all of the time. Because someone might come in the door and they might not be able to pay their utility bill, or they might not have food, and we're going to find the local food bank here, and we keep a list of resources in our office at all times just because we want to make sure people have access to everything. Transportation, you know, it's the worst. There's just not a lot of public transportation, so we feel that there might be some Delmarva Community Services, run some buses here and there, but to the extent that we can educate ourselves about all the resources that are around, more and more it will get out there. We're talking with Salisbury University. We're going to probably get some interns over the summer, over the next couple of years. And we're just going to keep doing what we're doing and talking to people.
How speaking of seniors, obviously we've got this sort of the grain, by the way, of the Eastern Shore, as they like
exactly
to say. More
right.
and more people, whether they move here or they just simply have been gotten old here, as it were.
Yeah.
How serious is that a problem in terms of that set of folks needing this kind of assistance? Because they've worked all of their lives, and most people accumulate some kind of assets, but there's a chunk of seniors that don't.
There's a huge chunk of seniors living in poverty on the Eastern Shore. And why we started this program was actually a volunteer lawyer had his 96-year-old mother who was going into an assisted living facility, and apparently it was very complex, and they had assets. And he sat down in my office. He said, I can't even imagine what poor people have to deal with, because if somebody becomes incompetent, again, I'm not a lawyer, if someone is incompetent and they can't manage their affairs, they can't write checks anymore, they can't manage their Social Security that's coming in, and they did not appoint somebody to take care of that, give somebody power of attorney to do that, we are then in a guardianship situation, which is oftentimes expensive, contested litigation. And that, what happens to those people? That is not, and they get taken advantage of that. You hear that all the time, that seniors have a niece or a nephew or a child who has their best interest in heart, who is not taking care of them, taking their Social Security money. So we're trying really, it's a preventative program, and we're really trying to prevent a guardianship from happening. So if we prepare all of these documents for them and let them know that they are taken care of, even advanced medical directives, food and hydration, what happens to me if something terrible happens and you didn't assign somebody to make that decision for you, we help them think about it. It's a difficult conversation to have. But if we partner with the senior centers and they feel the same way, we also have partnership with hospice up in Talbot County. That probably will be one of the next phone calls that we make down here, is see what the local hospice is doing. Can we help make sure that folks that are in there have all their ducks in a row?
The other big issue that's hit us since 2008 has been foreclosures. What have you seen it and how? I mean, I've heard stories and newspaper news reports about, you know, banks foreclosing and they get these notices and then suddenly they no longer have a home. What have you seen, particularly with this 10-year period, which seems to really sort of span that
downturn? That's exactly right.
Downturn.
So statewide, back in about 2008, 2010, the chief judge of the state, Chief Judge Bell, knew that mortgage foreclosures were a huge problem in the state of Maryland. Right now,
Maryland is still number two in highest foreclosures. Is that crazy? And we have a lot of hot pockets in on the Eastern Shore for foreclosures. Aside from Prince George's County, I think is like the highest. And there's a different kind of foreclosure. There's people who had big, huge homes, $700,000 home, were underwater, or people who lost their jobs. Watermen, farmers lost jobs, lost their ability. Medical bills prevented them from being able to make their foreclosure. So we've been a part of a statewide foreclosure pro bono prevention project since 2010. We still offer foreclosure services. We have an excellent team of experts and lawyers, and our foreclosure project manager is extremely helpful and takes care of our clients from soup to nuts. The problem is with foreclosure is people are calling us when their house is going up for sale. They are not calling us when they're just late on their mortgage. Why? Because they're ashamed, embarrassed, paralyzed, worried, scared. The problem with legal services in a low-income community is that they're usually terrified, and they don't understand that their problem is maybe legal. They see foreclosure as a financial problem. They see a family law matter as an emotional problem, and they don't have a framework for the law, and they don't think it's attainable, and they don't think that they have access to it. So we have so many barriers to getting our services out to folks, but foreclosure remains probably our number two case. Family law is number one, highest percentage of cases that we have. I'll tell you, these elder law cases, though, are probably going to eclipse foreclosure and family law, I'd say probably by the end of the year. There are seven senior centers in Wicomico County.
And we visited each of them to get feedback, to find out what their needs are. And even now, up and running, we just did a legal clinic with Sure Up, with their grandparent program, foster grandparent program. And they had a turnout of, I believe, 55. And out of that, I believe 20 cases were resolved, with ones either getting advanced medical directives or wills, or, you know, financial power of attorney, or whatever the case may be. So we know that that's an effective model to go out, let people know the services are available. Because, again, would we have met these people someplace else? Probably not. But by being there and helping them to see what their options are, they could take advantage of it. And there's a measure of empowerment, knowing that you can take care of your legal matter, and it's not going to cost you money to do so, because most people don't have the kind of resources to be able to afford it. Mm-hmm. So that's a key factor in why Mishore Pro Bono is expanding so rapidly, is because people do need it. They just need to know that it's there, and then they can take advantage of it.
It's a hard sell. It's a hard sell to lawyers to do the work. It's a hard sell to funders to fund us, because estate planning, why would we? But that's what it's called. But if you are poor, you still have, when somebody passes away, you still have to open an estate, is what it's called. So we have to educate funders and local people who might want to donate to this program. And it's hard. It's hard work.
In terms of donations, I mean, is there any kind of funding that comes from the state, or what's the percentage?
Talk about the percentage. We do have some state funding from the judiciary, from the administrative office of the courts, and most of our funding is project specific. So, for example, you know, the Stillman Foundation funds specifically the Elder Law Project, and we do have some general funding from the Maryland Legal Services Corporation that funds the other 33 legal services programs throughout the state. What we are lacking is local resources, local funding. People in the community that we're serving, seeing that we are helping build up the fabric of this community.
Why do you think that is?
What? Because they don't understand what we do.
Oh, do you think it's that they don't understand what you do, or do you think they don't know that there's a problem?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's when you hear Midshore Pro Bono, they think we're a lawyer program. Why would I give money to a lawyer program? We're asking lawyers to do this work for free, and they're doing it for free. We are asking to support the program so Juanita and my staff and all of the programs that we run can be sustained, so that we can go out into the community in these little pockets all over. We have to cover more than 2,600 square miles. It's a large, rural, challenging community to cover, and we're helping people save their homes, get jobs, become employed. One of my big appeals will be down here. It would be to the anyone who's employing somebody, hang up one of our signs in your lunchroom, because maybe you have employees who are missing work because of family law matters, custody matters. They're worried about foreclosure. Maybe you can't hire enough people because their record needs to be expunged. Let us expunge your record so you can be gainfully employed and be a better member of society. Let us help these clients who feel downtrodden, you know, get some sense of accomplishment and empowerment so that they can become better members of this community and therefore become better employees, right? So we serve a very invisible population. People are not going to go to their bosses and saying, I'm going through this terrible divorce. That's why I'm so late. Or I have terrible credit card debt. There are so many other barriers to becoming a whole, you know, just having a regular life. And many
by the way,
illegal.
You mentioned it. How serious is something like debt in general and particularly credit card debt? And how do you deal with that? Or are you guys...
Well, again, it's just a matter of outreach and education to clients. We have a great consumer protection program for clients who are facing third-party debt buyer cases. So did you watch the movie The Big Short? You know, so makes me cry every time I think about that movie. But that happened. And so here are a lot of people who are facing credit card debt. A lot of it can be dismissed. We have a good bankruptcy program where people can get bankruptcy assistance for free. We do bankruptcy clinics. It's just a matter of getting it out to the public that here are all the things that we offer and how do we offer that? How do we concisely say it and frame it in a way that somebody's going to say, oh, I'm going to call them.
Juanita, so when somebody comes in and you're the intake paralegal, as they like to say, So if I have a problem or if I have a legal issue, what's the process? I mean, in terms of interacting with you, I'm assuming it obviously is different than any particular individual issue or case. But
first of all, we'll let them know we are concerned about them, and we'll do a process where we take their information, find out what their legal issues actually are, explain to them that we have attorneys who will work for them to help them resolve their legal issue. And that's provided that they qualify, because obviously these are all income guidelines that they have to meet. But once they do that, we'll refer them to an attorney or to a legal clinic where they can get more information and get an appointment to settle their legal issue. Also, one of the things I think I'm going to enjoy doing is doing legal research for any cases that might need a little more than just the general thing for our attorney, so that it won't be so much work for them to be able to provide the assistance that they need. I'll be able to do the background research for them, have it ready for them so that they can act on the case when it comes before them rather than consuming a lot of their time, because obviously time is a big factor in whether or not an attorney wants to help out or not. So that can be a big boost for them.
Well, we've been speaking with Sandy Brown. She's the executive director of Midshore Pro Bono, and also Juanita Sutton, who is the intake paralegal, about opening up offices actually in Salisbury. And we've look forward to that and see how that works
out. Thank you so much.
And if I could just real quick.
You go right ahead.
Tell us what our address is. 212 West Main Street, which is in the gallery building and on Salisbury's downtown plaza on the third floor, suite 302. Our telephone number is 410-829-0394. And our office hours will be from 10 to 3, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, starting March 1st. And we're looking forward to serving our community.
Well, I appreciate you guys stopping
by.
Thank
you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.